The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. He is still traveling. He's in Israel, I believe, at the moment. He'll be traveling to the Netherlands soon and then be back with you all shortly. So I'm continuing the chain of guest presenters. Or we had that recorded program on Monday. Sam Livingston was in here yesterday with his just really informative program on Winston Churchill and the history of Israel. Lots of great quotes from Churchill and even some material there on Churchill's love of the Bible and just an aspect of Churchill that we don't hear so much about. Well, unfortunately, the big news of the day is another shooting. That shooting that, if you heard the top of the hour news, took place at the YouTube headquarters in San Bruno in California, where Nassim Agdam shot and wounded three people, one of which I think is in critical condition. I think one was serious. So people in a very bad way there before shooting herself. Yet another tragic situation. Now, Nassim Agdam, she seems generally a pretty crazy person, kind of far left animal rights activist, does videos on things like hand art, whatever that is. But she has been very angry with YouTube. She blamed them for, quote, filtering her videos. She accused them of showing her videos to fewer people than would otherwise have seen it, saying that they're being unfair. I guess she made money from YouTube and was saying that YouTube were ripping her off or artificially decreasing the number of people watching videos so she couldn't make money, this kind of thing. Knowing nothing to me, it seemed unlikely. Her videos are probably not popular because they weren't very good and kind of crazy, but it's easier to just blame YouTube. So a terrible situation with some bad news, but at the same time, this shooting follows at a time where there's a huge discussion going on more and more over what can you and what can't you say online. And I'm sure in the wake of this attack, we're going to see even more on that subject. What can't you say? What can you say? What kind of videos are allowed? How do you share videos? This kind of thing. I mean, recently YouTube banned all videos promoting gun sales. And initially when the attack took place, many thought the shooter would be somebody basically from the other side of the political spectrum, angry about that. You've got even, in the UK, someone is facing jail time potentially now because he made a video of a dog doing a Nazi salute and uploaded it to YouTube. And a judge ruled that that was hate speech. The guy did it as a joke. Apparently, I guess the judge doesn't find it funny and could be sending the guy to jail. You have people getting their accounts suspended from platforms like Twitter just from circulating articles, even articles that are published by the mainstream media. So let's look a bit at this trend today. We'll get into some news from the Middle East later on in the program. There's also been some very significant pieces of news there. We'll talk more about this Hamas's so-called March of Return and some of the implications for Israel, the broader long-term implications for Israel from this march. Also some very significant news coming out of Yemen. So lots of big events to talk about. But we'll start by discussing some of this this subject of what can be things you can't say online. Because we live in a situation where just a handful of countries have a huge influence on the access of billions to news and information. Now, not total control. You can still find videos and articles that YouTube or that Facebook don't want to host or share. but still a massive influence. They can help somebody spread an article to millions or just limit it to those who maybe would go to that particular website anyway. We have a situation where there are literally billions of websites. So how do you get heard above the noise? Well, that's pretty hard. Being ranked highly, having your articles ranked highly by Google, by Facebook, your videos ranked highly by YouTube, these are in some cases websites used by billions. And so having that can make a huge, huge difference to a website's success. Or alternatively, other courses websites can go with is they can advertise. But again, it's the same, slightly different, but a fairly small handful of countries that control, or companies that control, a vast amount of advertisements as well on the web. So yes, lots of people can now say lots of things on the internet, but at the same time, if you want to spread it beyond just kind of a few people, well, that's in the hands of just a few companies. So small changes to the way that these websites display articles can make a massive difference. Websites have become big and then even gone back to nothing again, thanks to just relatively small changes in Google's algorithm or in how Facebook ranks articles. And being ranked higher can mean millions more seeing your articles. So that puts these websites in position of a lot of power, but also a very difficult position. Do you know how long it would take to watch all the videos uploaded to YouTube on an average day? It wouldn't be a year, 2 years, 10 years, 50 years. 50 years worth of videos uploaded to YouTube in just an average day. To keep up just with one day's worth of videos, you'd have to spend most of your life watching. How does YouTube keep up with what's going up on their website? Now, Facebook, you have 2.2 billion monthly active users. Somewhere between, a bit under a third of the global population making posts or going on there at least once a month. How do you police what 2.2 billion are saying in public? So they are in a somewhat of a tough situation. And then you get people like this crazy woman who went up to YouTube and started shooting people. So it's a tough job. But at the same time, more and more of these platforms, they are clamping down on what people are allowed to say, even when it's the truth. I'll read some quotes from a Spectator piece by Douglas Murray from last week. Unfortunately, I guess I didn't note the title, but it was on the Spectator, I think, on their Coffeehouse blog on Thursday. But he starts by talking about the two big events from France over the last couple of weeks, where you had that gunman who took hostages in a supermarket. And you had Lieutenant Colonel Beltram, who swapped himself for a hostage and who ultimately got killed in that situation and is rightly being praised as a hero. You also had Mireille Knoll, the 85-year-old Holocaust survivor who was stabbed and burned and killed, murdered for being a Jew. So you had those two events in France. And Douglas Murray writes, what are we to think about this? Well, that depends on what we're allowed to know. There's been some outcry about the murder of Mademoiselle Knoll, not least because of its similarity to the murder of 66-year-old Sarah Halmy last year, and it has been described as an act of anti-Semitism. But you might have to search, certainly in the English language press, to find out what variety of anti-Semite might have stabbed a Jewish grandmother 11 times and then burned her body. Was it a member of the National Front or Momentum? So who carried out the crime? Well, he quotes Sky News. They reported two men, including a neighbour, have been charged with the 85-year-old's murder. So doesn't really tell us much about the type of person that carried out the crime. But in the French press, you find, okay, actually, it was individuals with a Muslim background. The same with that terrorist attack at the supermarket, which ended in the death of that police officer. Douglas Murray says that only some of the news stories carry any details about the man. He was apparently called Redan Lakhdim. He was 26 years old, was born in Morocco and became a French national where his main contributions to the life of the nation consisted of petty criminality and jihadism. And he writes, "For the time being, we can deplore the murder of an 85-year-old Holocaust survivor and praise the heroism of Arnaud Beltrame, but do not do either victim the decency of trying to learn much information about their killers, what might have motivated them, or what views we might come to as a consequence. To do so would be to trespass upon the fiercest dogmas of our day. We can feel sad, and we can tell people that we feel sad, but who would dare do anything more than that?" He goes on to write, "I frame this in terms of what can we think about this for a very particular reason, which is that this is now a question of which free citizens of free countries must consider very carefully. In the wake of a number of official and unofficial government directives across Europe in recent months, there is now a battle going on for the education of the general public." And he's right, a battle going on for the education of the general public. Social media networks, especially Facebook and Twitter, have in recent months begun a scraping of their platforms. Embarrassed by their intermittent exposure by the old media, they also face threats of increasing liabilities from national governments and security agents. So platforms which have for years allowed terrorist groups like Hezbollah to proselytize with impunity have now begun to enforce a new, higher standard. But as Murray talks about, unfortunately, that means for many of these different platforms, they've decided, well, they need to crack down on both sides. The side of the terrorists and those that kill people, and the side that criticizes terrorists and those that kill people. And so they're applying this very uneven standard across the board. I'll keep quoting from his article. He writes, "Earlier this year, the former founder of the English Defence League, Tommy Robinson, was suspended on Twitter for tweeting a statistic about rape gangs, something that has been much in the news of late. Indeed, if we're not going to merely pass around cat photos on social media, discussion of the mass rape of the nation's children might seem to be a legitimate activity. Just this week, another such gang has been convicted, this time once again in Oxford. Saying rape gang or grooming gang is, of course, itself a get-out, as is the dishonest and deliberately misinforming term Asian rape gang. But it's hard to know what one can say these days. Muslim rape gang or Pakistani rape gang may be accurate, but it will also bring forth a world of problems, including flaggings on social media. In recent days, readers have shown me how they've been suspended from Facebook just for posting my recent Spectator article," he writes, on this subject. And he goes on to talk about how that statistic that this individual who had their Twitter account suspended and I think eventually completely cancelled, that statistic that he shared was true. And he wasn't making anything up. He was sharing some true statistics. And he lost his account for it. People sharing an article. This is for a mainstream media article from The Spectator. This isn't any kind of fringe blog. It's definitely not some kind of Russian-based fake news article. This is something from a well-respected, old-school, mainstream media publication, and they're getting their accounts from Facebook suspended for sharing it. Murray goes on to write, "In Germany, friends and readers describe to me how they're learning anew how to read their daily newspapers. When the news says a person was killed by another person, for instance, and no names or other identifying characteristics are given, people guess correctly that the culprit is probably of migrant background. For the time being, serious crimes are still being reported, but the decision has been taken that the public should not really be informed about them. Of course, if you were to report them or mull them on social media, you would now risk losing that platform. So the media isn't much use, and social media isn't either. So this is having a chilling effect. The mainstream media is kind of reluctant enough to talk about these things at the best of times. I mean, the whole thing with the Muslim rape gangs, there was a huge outcry about that a few years ago. And it came out that they were basically able to get away with this because nobody wanted to talk about it, because it was politically incorrect. And so there was a huge outcry, you know, this big response from the general public. Well, we can't allow this to happen. You know, we've got to address it. And here we are 2-3 years later, and people still aren't allowed to talk about the problem. Even after there are even official reports condemning the way that political correctness was, you know, stopping these problems from being solved, was making these problems worse. But as he points out, the mainstream media, they're reluctant enough to talk about these things at the best of times. But now, you know, they know that if they do, they'll be penalized on social media. Their articles won't be shared. And that can mean millions of hits. That can mean lost revenue. And ultimately, at the end of the day, for most of these news organizations, they exist to make a profit. So what are they going to do? Just stop talking about these subjects. Or, well, okay, well, if we were really going to accurately talk about what's happening, help people understand the problem and get to the cause, well, we talk about Muslim rape gangs. But that will mean we don't get shared on Facebook, we don't get shared on Twitter, nobody will read the article. Well, we'll just have to euphemistically say Asian rape gangs. Murray writes, in this situation, how are we to deal with issues like that of grooming gangs? The communities from which the culprits come don't seem to want to address the issue. Mainstream society and politics has shown itself repeatedly unwilling and unable to do more than commission further endless inquiries into these issues. And passing around what facts are known appears to have become difficult, and perhaps in the near future wholly impossible. The social media platforms will say that the facts are passed around in a hateful manner, but it's hard to see how exactly one might frame the mass gang rape of children in an unabashedly upbeat fashion. As it is with rape gangs, so it is with nameless, perpetratorless crimes in Germany. And so eventually it will be with the burning of a Holocaust survivor in her Paris flat. We are still allowed to notice the tragedy. We can observe the passing age, but we are losing the ability and the right to point to the pyre or to identify it, even as it mounts. So a dangerous situation, and it's one that's getting even, you know, that's getting even worse. You've had Facebook coming under a huge amount of attack after this whole Cambridge Analytica scandal. I don't want to go into all the ins and outs of that long scandal. But now they're completely reviewing a lot of their processes and what they allow on their website. And so could you get to the point that basically if you want to get a message out to the millions, well, you can only say smooth things, anything that's controversial, it just can't go. That certainly seems like the way that we're heading. So what's the solution? Is it to get governments involved, to have them regulate social media to make sure that people can't be shut down for sharing the facts? Well, Europe is certainly looking at doing a lot more of that. But if you know Europe's history with free speech, that's something, a trend to be even more worried about, at least especially over here in Europe, where if you could really see if governments start getting involved and they're just going to be even more strict in regulating exactly what people can say online. I mean, even in the UK, let me introduce you to Lauren Southern. A few weeks ago, Vice magazine, they had an article titled, "Was Jesus Gay?" Quite an offensive title. I am sure it's an absolutely abominable article. I haven't read it or looked for it. But Southern, you know, saw this article and decided to conduct an interesting experiment. Well, she wanted to see, well, what happened if you tried saying the same thing about Allah? What if you made a pamphlet? Is Allah gay? And the result was she was banned from visiting Britain. This is something that's becoming increasingly common. Britain banning people with any kind of controversy there. And she was banned for doing that, for being a racist. I'm sure nobody from Vice has ever been banned from visiting Britain for saying, was Jesus gay? That apparently, you know, her visit, they said, was not conducive to British values, something along those lines. Well, apparently what Vice magazine was doing, well, that's absolutely right in line with British values. That's fine. But what Laura Southern was doing, well, no, that's not that's not in line with British values. I mean, really, all she was doing was protesting in for free speech. Now, for just about any media organization, now going back to the social media, if you want your articles to be seen on social media beyond your very most loyal of loyal followers, well, you need to promote your content these days. You know, pay money for them to appear higher up. And it's something that's worked very well for us at The Trumpet. It can be a very cost-effective way of generating more views, of bringing in more people to see that, to see your content. And because social media have so much information about people, they know who their friends are. You know, they are getting very good at targeting that at people who are most likely to be interested in what you're saying. But we've had to stop doing that entirely on Twitter. Anything at all controversial on subjects they just don't want to talk about, for LGBT, for example, well, you can't promote articles on that subject. You can't promote articles, I think, anything that we talked about on Europe or Germany. Anything in the wake of a tragedy, if you're talking of trying to get to the cause of why this happened, how can we fix it? How can we solve this problem? How can we stop having this problem again? Nope, can't be promoted. And so, well, we've just given up promoting things on Twitter because they're so restrictive in what you can promote. Now, we still have our Twitter page, and we're not, you know, we can still, I don't think they've cracked down at all on what we say on that, but they're very selective on what you're allowed to promote. Now, you don't have to work for a media organization to be worried about people not being allowed to say things online. Yesterday, I wrote my Trumpet brief about Liam Allen, a young man who nearly went to jail because of facts that were withheld in his case. He was accused of rape. There were texts that comprehensively proved him innocent, but they weren't revealed until the very last minute. And if it weren't for I think it was the prosecuting barrister going above and beyond in really making sure everything was done fair, and he kind of saw that something that the police had done seemed a bit off and a bit dodgy, and he really put his foot down and insisted that these text messages that the police didn't want to hand over, he insisted that they were handed over. But if he hadn't have done that, then this young man could have well gone to jail for a crime that he didn't commit, because of facts that were withheld. And as I mentioned that Trumpet brief, there are several similar cases in the UK, and now every single rape case in the UK is under review. This was such a concerning problem. Thousands of these trials under review. And that's what happens when you hide facts in a court of law in an individual trial, when there's evidence that you're not allowed to talk about, important evidence that you're not allowed to talk about. And now, we're starting to do the same thing for the fate of our nation, for the fate of our society, have more and more things that we just can't talk about. You know, say things like police brutality. The full facts about some of these alleged attacks by police officers on what are meant to be unarmed, completely innocent victims, you know, the full facts, the full picture, well, that's not in a lot of the mainstream media, and more and more it's going beyond just not being in the mainstream media to not being welcome at all. Not being allowed to talk about at all. Facts on the transgender movement, that's something that really not allowed to talk about at all in a lot of circles. You know, real evidence that we're doing real harm to our young people by telling them from incredibly early ages. I saw a couple of pieces, they were mostly from Scandinavia, where they were just taking boys and girls in preschool and getting them to dress up as the opposite gender, and all of these things just to really teach them, try and get them into this at the earliest ages. I think another was about a preschool, I can't remember where that was, where they they came in, the boys were boisterous, the girls were more feminine. And so the teacher saw that and they said, well, this isn't right. And so they had all these exercises designed to try and make the girls more masculine and boisterous and to feminize all of these boys deliberately. And, well, there are facts that we're doing real harm to our young people by doing those kind of things. That this is incredibly dangerous. But those facts just aren't welcome. That evidence, where that evidence is being ignored. And so where's that leading our society on that issue? Even things like, you know, statistics and facts on how much children need fathers, like Mr. Flurry talked about for a few different programs on this show. Oh, well, in some areas, in growing areas, well, that's offensive to single mothers or for people that don't live in heterosexual normal families. So, well, you can't talk about that either. And we live in an age where there's more and more facts that you can't talk about. And I'm not talking about outlawed opinions. But, and that would be bad enough, but facts that can't be shared. And there's a spirit behind this. There's a spirit. There's a reason why we live in an age where, you know, media, old media, new media, social media, where governments, where experts, where they're increasingly ignoring facts and suppressing evidence. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 12 talks about those in authority. It says they cast down the truth to the ground. You know, this is an age where people hate truth. They hate law. And this is something that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry really gets to the heart of in his free book, America Under Attack. That's a book that we'd be more than happy to send you, to ship to you anywhere in the world. You can order that on our website, thetrumpet.com. Just click on library at the top there and go to literature, and you can order that book. But I'll just read you a quote from the first chapter. And Mr. Flurry writes, such a massive lurch towards lawlessness has a cause. I want to show you exactly what that cause is. Most people will scoff at what I'm about to say, but it is absolutely true, and you can prove it from your Bible. The most lawless being in the universe is a spirit being, Satan the devil, Mr. Flurry writes. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4 calls him the god of this world. What does this mean? It means that this evil spirit being has frightening power, power we can hardly imagine. To say that he is the god of this world means that he rules. And even more, it means that the people of this world worship him. And it's not something that's talked about much at all, even in Christianity. But you can read plenty, even from the words of Jesus Christ himself, about Satan the devil and his influence on the world. In John chapter 8, Christ says that he talks about Satan. He says that this being, that there's no truth in him. He says that when he speaks of a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. The Bible is clear when it talks about a spirit being that pervades the whole earth, that is the god of this world, as Mr. Flurry mentioned in that passage that we just read. And he is the father of lies. He hates truth. He hates lawlessness. I mean, he hates law. And this is an unseen cause for the massive rejection of truth that you're just seeing all around you. At so many different levels, the cause for just people not wanting facts and evidence on all of these different areas. And the Bible talks about a time where the land cannot bear our words. Are you already at the time where Twitter promotions can't bear our words? That's the direction we're moving in. So you can read that booklet, America Under Attack. That will give you the background that you need on this whole movement. So again, you can order that on our website, thetrumpet.com. And just click on the library tab. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back and we'll talk about some news from the Middle East.
This is KPCG-FM and this is The Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Flurry's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. I want to talk about a few important stories from the Middle East now during the second half of today's program. The first comes from yesterday, where a Saudi oil tanker in international waters was attacked by the Iranian-backed Houthi militants in Yemen. And that may well sound like something far off and not really anything that relates to you, but this is something with huge potential implications. So this is off the coast of Yemen, the southern tip, which is just on that southern bit of Saudi Arabia. The attack took place inside the Red Sea, and Iran basically has a control of a good chunk of Yemen's coast there through this Houthi militant group, or terrorist groups, basically. This is the Red Sea. It's just a hugely important shipping lane, sea gate. There's the Suez Canal at one end of the Red Sea, leading out from the Red Sea into the Mediterranean Sea, and you have the Bab el-Mandeb Strait at the southern end of the Red Sea. And, 20,000 ships pass through the Suez Canal and Bab el-Mandeb each year. 20,000, average of 55 a day. 15% of all global maritime trade goes through that waterway. 10% of all global seaborne oil. And so, that's something that affects people all around the world, but it especially affects Europe. Almost all of seaborne trade between Europe and Asia goes through that passage, goes through the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, up the Red Sea, or down the Red Sea Suez Canal. That's about $700 billion worth of trade per year. So that goes through this area. And by attacking a Saudi oil tanker in that area, this Houthi militant group is demonstrating whether they can attack or they can threaten any oil tanker, any part of this trade going through the Red Sea there. You think Europe is worried about the Middle East now? Well, how would they react if Iranian-backed rebels start attacking this trade, almost all their seaborne trade, with Asia? That would be huge for Europe. Major changes in how they deal with, how they approach security, what the continent is even like. Now, there have been attacks here before by the Houthis, but they've generally been against military targets. And there are signs now that they could be changing tactics to attacking civilian shipping. And if that starts to happen, that's a huge deal for the global economy and for Europe. I'll just read a paraphrase here. Colonel Turki al-Maliki, the coalition's official spokesman, this anti-Houthi coalition, said the attack represents a dangerous threat to freedom of navigation and global trade at the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and Red Sea, and can also cause environmental damage and economic loss. He warned that these continued attempts shed light on how dangerous these militias are, and reaffirms the fact that the Al-Hadid port is still being used as a launching point for terrorist operations, as well as the smuggling of missiles and weapons. So these dangerous terrorist attacks going on in the Red Sea. The Drive had an article, and this is where they really point out how they could be starting to change and go after more of these civilian vessels, attacking the civilian traffic. They write, the incident does come after the Iranian-backed movement said it could decide to strike at commercial shipping. Commercial shipping, and otherwise look to hamper maritime movement through the region if the Saudis and their allies did not withdraw from the area around the last rebel-held port city of Al-Hudaya, or Al-Hadida. If the Saudi version of events is confirmed, this would be the second rebel attack to damage or destroy commercial vessels since the beginning of the year. On January 6, 2018, the Houthis attacked another tanker, but did not cause any damage. In that case, they reportedly used an unmanned explosive-filled boat. The group had used these unmanned craft in a number of previous attacks and attempted attacks on naval vessels, including against the Saudi frigate Al-Madina near this area in 2017. The group has used anti-ship missiles and sea mines to attack other coalition ships as well as American warships in response to the US government's logistical support and other military aid. After the January attack, Salah al-Samad, the head of the Houthi government in Yemen, said the group might increasingly pursue strategic operations in its fight against the Saudis and their partners. This threat included the possibility of cutting off the Red Sea, this is a quote, cutting off the Red Sea and international navigation. So these Iranian-backed rebels are threatening to cut the Red Sea and this vital waterway, 15% of the world's maritime trade, 10% of the world's seaborne oil trade. They're threatening to cut that off. Going back to this article from The Drive, though, for years now, they've been concerned that the Houthis or their various partners in Yemen could become a serious threat to maritime trade in the region as the Saudi-led coalition steps up its own campaign against the group and work to more tightly enclose rebel-held areas. There have been sporadic reports of attacks on commercial ships, which may have been more criminal than military in nature since at least 2016. They quoted from October 2016, the U.S. Navy's Office of Naval Intelligence, saying, we cannot rule out the possibility of Houthis attacking commercial shipping. More from this quote, it says, starting in October 2018, this is from the Office of Naval Intelligence, there have been a series of reported attacks and advisories issued to the commercial maritime industry. It goes on to, this is a quote back from The Drive. In addition to deliberate attacks on ships, military or commercial, the Houthis have also been employing improvised naval mines near the Mandeb Strait, a major trade route. It goes into some of the details of that trade route. So naval mines, these weapons pose a more indiscriminate threat and could help the group make good on Samad's threat to impede international navigation. What we do know is that the Houthis do have access to anti-ship missiles, drone boats and naval mines, among other increasingly advanced weaponry, and that they have been and still are a real threat militarily and commercial, or a real threat to military and commercial traffic, maritime traffic in the area around the Mandeb Strait. With continued and potentially increasing support from Iran's behind all of this, the group's ability to launch standoff attacks at sea and on land could further improve in the near term. In addition, the Houthis have also stepped up ballistic missile attacks against Saudi Arabia in recent months, as well as presenting an increasing challenge against Saudi-led coalition aircraft using surface-to-air missiles. In both cases, the Saudis, as well as the United States, have accused Iran of either supplying the rebels with those weapons or aiding in their local fabrication. And they had a pretty good infographic accompanying this piece on their website, which, obviously, because this is radio and you can't see me, I can't share with you, but that was called Iran Threatens Freedom of Navigation. Iran threatens freedom of navigation. Now, if you've been following what we've been saying about what's been going on in Yemen in particular, about Iran's strategy in the whole of the Middle East, that will be no surprise. We've been talking about Iran's strategy to threaten the freedom of navigation for years. In the April 2015 Trumpet edition, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, he wrote, the Houthis' takeover of Yemen was not just a grassroots revolution. It was a part of a deliberate and calculated Iranian strategy to conquer the Red Sea. So that's what they're aiming to do. One of its leaders after the 2011 Houthi uprising, they said, we and the Axis of Resistance are the new sultans of the Mediterranean and the Gulf. This was Mohammed Sadiq al-Husseini, advisor to, well, he was advisor to Mohammed Khatami, a former Iranian president. We in Tehran, Damascus, and Hezbollah's southern suburb of Beirut, Baghdad, and Sana'a will shape the region. We are the new sultans of the Red Sea as well. So they are aiming to take over this area. Mr. Flurry wrote again back in that 2015 article, the Houthi takeover in Yemen proves that Iran is implementing a bold strategy to control the vital sea lane from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. So hugely important. Here's what Mr. Flurry, well, here's the way he introduced a Key of David program from 2015. This program was called The Yemen Crisis on this subject.
Greetings, everyone. The pro-American country of Yemen was just overthrown this past week by the Houthis, a rebel group that is sponsored by Iran and really directed by them. So a lot is happening in that Arabian Peninsula at this time. Yemen is one of the most strategically important countries in the world, certainly in the Middle East, and I believe also in the world. That victory has shocked this world. It certainly shocked Europe and the Middle East and even the United States as well, because it's changing the course of the Middle East in many ways. And that's what we need to understand. And it's going to affect all of us. It's going to affect individual lives in this country in a way that I think it's hard for people to imagine. The Houthis, after they conquered the capital city of Yemen, began their battle cry of death to America and death to the Jews or the Jewish nation in the Middle East. That is their battle cry, and that's also the battle cry of Iran, who is directing them, and for a very, very great purpose as they see it, and strategically it is indeed critical.
So they have Iran has big ambitions for what they're doing and what they're doing with this rebel group. And we can read about where it's leading in the Bible. Daniel 11 talks about this. Well, it talks about it. You can read in Daniel 11 and verse 40, the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him and the king of the north shall come against him. So Iran is this king of the south and they're pushing at Europe, pushing at this European king of the north. There's conflict building between the two. Iran is spreading out. It's trying to gain control of the Red Sea. It's threatening this commercial shipping that really especially threatens Europe. Now, maybe they won't attack a whole bunch of commercial shipping right now because it will know that that would get a pushback from Europe and it wants to wait a bit more before it gets that pushback. I don't know. But it definitely shows Iran's strategy of trying to use these areas to push at Europe. The Bible talks about Iran moving into Egypt, into Libya, into Ethiopia. And Mr. Flores talked about how this exposes Iran's strategy, that they're trying to get a hold of these sea gates. You know, they're trying to go into Ethiopia, the other side of that crucial Bab el-Mandeb sea gate on the Red Sea. They want to make sure that they have control over that sea gate, that they can cut it off. And maybe they come under pressure from the Saudis in Yemen, maybe not. But they're going to try and get control of that sea gate. At Egypt, getting control of the Suez Canal. Libya, on the shores of the Mediterranean, getting quite close now to Italy. That's their strategy. And you can see that conflict, that Iranian conflict with Europe, that pushing that would force a response from Europe. You can see that building out of the news from yesterday. But there's a very closely related conflict that you can also see brewing in the Middle East from the news this week. Mr. Stephen Flurry spoke on the so-called March of Return and the events in the Gaza border on Monday's show. And that show's a great place to get the facts on what happened here. And that's another place where facts are just often not welcome. People just want to blame Israel, as we talked about in the first half. But there are a couple of good articles that I wanted to share with you just on the broader picture of the danger Israel faces here, and the danger specifically from Iran. This was from Al Monitor, Israel's Gaza nightmare. And they write, March 30th, Great March of Return to the Gaza border fence was nothing more than act one of an unfolding drama, a dress rehearsal, or possibly a pilot for what one could expect to see in the near future. The Israel Defense Force, the IDF, are now preparing for April 17th, Palestinian Prisoners' Day, also the eve of Israel's Memorial Day for fallen soldiers, and for May 15th, the Nakba Day, so-called Catastrophe Day, also the day after the United States is expected to open its new embassy in Jerusalem. Further complicating matters, the later event coincides with the start of the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. The Great March of Return was initiated and orchestrated by Hamas in an attempt to change the rules of the game, to create a new balance of power and send a message to Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas that the struggle for the hearts and minds of the Palestinian people is far from over. Hamas is alive and kicking, and it is marching as well. It goes on to talk about how Israel and Egypt have had some success in stopping rocket smuggling and in shutting down some of these tunnels that Hamas has built in Gaza. And so Hamas is finding now a different way to attack Israel, to spread terror. A way, as they call it here, to reinvent itself. A popular mass march by tens of thousands of people all headed to the Israeli border at the Eretz checkpoint, where they would trample the fence, break the Israeli siege, and move on towards Jerusalem, or at least towards the southern town of Ashkelon. Images of IDF tanks, this is the Al Monitor writing, and helicopters firing at civilians marching for their freedom. And that's what Hamas wants. And that, they write, would be Israel's worst imaginable nightmare. They quoted a senior Israeli defense official who said, just imagine what could have happened. Picture the outcome if they would have burst through the fence, even at a single point, and begun marching into Israel. It would have ended in a bloodbath. We don't have the privilege of allowing masses of Palestinians to march to Jerusalem, Ashkelon, or any of the kibbutzim along the fence. We have no choice but to employ enormous force, and that would have resulted in dozens, if not hundreds, of casualties. The images would have been a huge victory for the Palestinians. As far as we're concerned, the fact that the recent event ended with 16 casualties, 12 of whom have already been identified as Hamas terrorists, but without any casualties among the women and children, is a very significant achievement on our part. It should not be taken for granted. And that's, you know, he's right. Israel couldn't allow these massive crowds of just thousands and thousands with so many terrorists in there to march into Jerusalem. They'd have to be stopped, but how do you do that without this? You know, that is the dilemma that Hamas are trying to cause. They're trying to force Israel to have to kill lots of their own people. Another senior military official talking to Al Monitor, understand this fence is a border in every sense of the word. No country in the world would allow terrorists to break through its borders. All anyone has to do is listen to the leaders of Hamas. They did not call this event a demonstration against the occupation, but a march of return. They announced that they would be marching to Jerusalem. They declare again and again that they do not recognize Israel's right to exist. That is why they leave us no choice but to block them by force, no matter what the cost. And as that article brings out, well, what we saw last week was just the dress rehearsal. They may well try this again in bigger numbers. There's more of these dates coming up where they could try and force their way through. I'll read one more article before we finish up, or some quotes. This is from George Friedman at Geopolitical Futures, and he has some great points in putting this together in its overall context. He writes, the events in Gaza have to be viewed in a broader strategic context. There were unconfirmed reports last weekend that the Israeli Air Force bombed Hezbollah forces operating on the Lebanon-Syria border. Surveillance of Lebanon and attacks on Hezbollah forces near or in Syria are not new, but a pattern is emerging. All of Israel's frontiers have become or threatened to become active. In Syria, Iran has substantial power and deep influence over the Assad regime and its actions. In Lebanon, Hezbollah, an Iranian-dominated force, is a serious power. Hezbollah has also played a major role in the Syrian civil war. He talks about all of the missiles they have and how its ground forces are being restored. He writes, since Israel's founding, the Arabs and Israelis have faced fundamental strategic problems. The Arabs have never been able to create a unified command around the Israeli periphery to wage extended, coordinated warfare, taking advantage of their superior numbers. The Israelis are incapable of absorbing extensive casualties in the tens of thousands, given the country's small population and relatively small effective fighting force. Israel's strategy has always been to either take advantage of divisions in the Arab world or encourage them. In addition, Israel's warfighting strategy has been to impose a rapid end to fighting, even if this means an inconclusive war to minimize casualties. The ideal strategy for the Arabs has been forcing Israel into a war along its entire periphery, from Lebanon and Syria down into the southwest. So they want that would be ideal for them if they can force Israel into a war along all of its borders. He talks about attempts at this in the past, but they were never able to really successfully do that. And so he writes, and so the events in Gaza are important. Unlike previous episodes when the Iranians provided Hamas with material support from far away, the Iranians are now in Syria and Lebanon. He talks about how right now they couldn't do a full peripheral war because Israel and Egypt are at peace and Israel and Jordan are at peace. But he goes on to talk about how Iran's going to be trying to gain more influence in those areas. And as they do, it becomes more dangerous with Israel. He writes, still, the possibilities of active fronts in Lebanon and Syria, coupled with another threat from Gaza, including rockets that cannot be rapidly suppressed by Israel, pose a threat to Israel. From the Arab and now Iranian point of view, a sudden victory is not the goal. Rather, the goal is to impose casualties on Israel's military and civilian population for an extended period to undermine Israel's ability and will to fight. Before the Iranian presence, this was difficult to achieve. It remains difficult, but not impossible. That is why the Israelis are extremely sensitive to anything happening in Gaza, and why the Palestinians in Gaza are carefully testing the Israelis. Hamas was on the ropes a short while ago, but now, with Iranian, Sunni and Shiite cooperation, opportunities emerge. But now with Iran, opportunities emerge. For Israel, the key at the moment is political. And it talks about how they've got to do what they can to make sure they're still at peace with Egypt and with Jordan. So like I said, you know, Iran is going to be working to get control with Egypt. And we talked about Daniel 11. It says that's going to happen. And that just adds to this encirclement of Israel. He writes, given recent events in Gaza and Iranian power in Syria and Lebanon, it is not premature to consider the potential shape of a conflict. Hezbollah rockets from the north, Hamas rockets from the south, Israeli forces dispersed on multiple fronts and ground operations will likely not break Israel, but they would strain it and would be a step in reshaping the balance of power in the region, which is the goal for Iran. And he talks about how this is also, it fits nicely in with their plan to dominate the Arab world. So some good analysis there, you know, right in the midst of what's going on in Israel with this march on this march of return at the Gaza border. Well, right in the middle of that, there is Iran spreading across the Middle East and threatening Israel. And that's exactly the picture painted in Daniel 11. You know, right at the heart even of what's in Daniel 11. It talks about the king of the north entering into the glorious lands. He goes into Israel. It talks about him planting his tabernacles between the seas, the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea. Israel is right at the heart of this clash. And so much of it revolves around Israel. And this is why you need to be watching Israel, watching Jerusalem, and especially over these next few weeks as this clash builds in the Middle East. We'll just play a quick soundbite from A Key of David where Mr. Flurry talks about the importance of doing this.
The Bible says that God has chosen Jerusalem. Now, why would God choose Jerusalem? And surely, if God chooses a city himself, you'd think that would be, well, pretty impressive news in this world, but not many people pay attention to that, and yet we are to become perfect as our Father in heaven is perfect, Matthew 5 and verse 48. So if he chooses Jerusalem, then that strongly tells us we should choose it as well. Jerusalem, as it is at the heart, the very heart of the eternal plan of God, and it is the key to your future, your spiritual future. It's the key to your future with God. That's how important it is.
So it's right at the heart of what's going on now, right at the heart of the future as well. So keep watching this important area. As you do this, a great book booklet to help you understand this area is the King of the South booklet. I guess it's quite a thick, or thick for a booklet anyway. But it's just the excellent background that you need in the history, the prophecy of this whole area of what is Iran's doing, explaining Daniel 11, Jerusalem's role in this, the role that Europe will play in this area. All of the details you need to understand what is happening in this clash that's building. So with this potential for increased conflict in this area, especially over the next few months with those dates that we talked about coming up in April and in May, this book is a great place to go to get the context that you need as you watch that news. So that's the King of the South booklet. And again, you can get that for free. You can read that one online. Or order your own print edition with free shipping and everything on our website, thetrumpet.com. Just go to the library tab up at the top right-hand corner. That's about it from me. You can send in your comments at td@kpcg.fm. And Mr. Loka will be hosting, Mr. Andrew Loka, the show tomorrow. So thanks for listening and tune in again then.